and welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. I'm Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian.
And thanks, Sebastian, for holding the fort last week. But I wasn't twiddling my thumbs.
You were away.
I was away.
Meeting people.
Actually, I was at a conference in Toronto, which was handy because I was able to do some interviews in Toronto. I interviewed the Asian Community Aid Society, I interviewed Ryan Tran, but we're going to start off with a quick story.
Actually, first we should warn the listeners that if you hear what appears to be a banshee or a siren or perhaps a tortured cat, because we are in the middle of a tempest. And
yeah,
this
crazy wind.
This
crazy wind today.
Very sensitive. Yeah. I almost got knocked over on the way here. It was
knock you down kind of weather.
It was knock you down kind of weather. Yeah, like a fish that you find at the back of your fridge. You're like, oh, should have eaten this 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that's a knock you down kind
of like
fish.
But like the weather equivalent of that. So what are we starting with?
Yes. So yes, interview with Ryan Tran later on today. We also have a second interview with Ryan Tran. I'm talking about Pride. So we'll actually kick off with Toronto Pride and the police. Right. Debacle, which actually is going to bleed into next week's show as well, and maybe the show after, where we've lined up a few interviews come at it from a different angle.
It's a big story. We're going to be talking about it for at least a couple months.
Absolutely. I don't know if there's enough words for...
You talk about Grindr?
No, we'll do that later.
Oh, okay.
But I'm talking about the Toronto Pride... So the Toronto Pride and the this 519 Centre,
yeah,
and like the Sherbourne Health Centre,
yeah.
And really the who's who, the Toronto AIDS Society, I think, also joined in, all wrote Toronto Police a letter being like, by the way, this you marching in the parade thing after epically messing up, you know, it's just, what, were you surprised at the reaction to TPS joining the parade?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I feel like, you know, it's free to ask. Submitting the paperwork was them asking permission, and they got told no. And the way that I feel about that is, last year I was a little bit more sympathetic to the debate. You know, that there were good reasons for them to not go, and that there were supportive reasons for them to go. This year, nope. When I heard that a whole bunch of organizations told the Toronto Police, you know, please don't show up this year. My response was, yeah, that checks out. That makes sense to me. I would like to support the openly serving officers within Toronto Police. But if they want to march in uniform, they can march with another service. I don't think the Toronto Police banner should be in the parade anywhere. If you are, you know, doing the brave thing and openly serving as a trans or queer individual within the Toronto Police.
Yeah.
Durham will take you. York will take you. Blue and Proud?
Out and Proud, I think it is.
Out and Proud? No, that's something else. But there's a police, LGBTQ police organization. It's Blue and Proud or Proud Blue. There's blue in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But anyway, march with them, you know. Just do not carry... Yeah. The Toronto banner, because it does not deserve to be in the parade.
And we're not saying
that... You as an individual do.
Yeah, yeah. We're not saying Toronto Police, the people, don't deserve to be in that. I talked to Ryan about, would you feel comfortable reporting a mugging, a rape?
Yeah.
You know, falling over and losing a wallet? And the answer is no. And I think he was speaking to Southeast Asian, and there's talk from the South Asian. No one would feel comfortable reporting any crime. Can you imagine being in a city where you don't feel safe and the people who keep you safe, you can't trust?
Well, I mean, I did used to live in Toronto. Yeah. I used to live in Toronto and I lived in a very rough neighborhood. And then I moved to a slightly less rough neighborhood.
But did you believe that if you phoned police, they would take you seriously?
If something had happened to me, I would have phoned the police, but I would not have expected stellar service. I would have expected something, but
that's the difference.
Maybe not much.
People aren't phoning the police because they don't expect anything out of them. And you'll hear the interview later, but he describes it as hopeless, where there's a feeling that folks within that community are never taken seriously. And we go into that in a bit more detail later.
Mm.
So do they really deserve a spot matching with Pride, with rainbows on their cars? And, you know, does Toronto Police Inc., do they deserve that space in the parade when they were so ineffective at catching a serial killer?
Well, this is how I would frame it. I would just say the parade is for community organizations and their allies. And the police failed to demonstrate allyship. That's how I would say it.
I think the police in Toronto also failed to demonstrate policing, but that's just my rather stern take.
A lot of it really, like, the more the details come out, it seems to be that it may not have been about gay men. It may have just been general incompetence, and gay men fell through the cracks a little bit more than usual. So, I mean, I don't think it was, I mean, personally, I don't think it was deliberate or targeted. I think it was incompetence, and I think that when it was identified, their answer was shrug, but...
It's that bit that I take issue with. Even if it was bureaucratic incompetence that's evenly spread out across multiple people, the community said...
There were years of complaints. Yeah,
the community's like, people are going missing all the time.
Yeah.
There is a serial killer. Actually, the counselor for the area, and I forget her name, I have it handy somewhere. The counselor for the area turned around and asked senior superintendents. And these senior superintendents told the counselor, no, community's overreacting. There absolutely is no serial killer. We trust us. It's not happening. And then within a week or two, they announced they have the biggest serial killer investigation TPS has ever faced. It is absolutely shambolic.
When I was a kid, Paul Bernardo was out, and there everyone was like, you know, don't go up to, I think it was a cream-colored van, and they were very specific. They stopped saying, you know, stop taking candy from strangers, and they were very specific, like, this make and model of vehicle, you should stay away from that. And everyone was like, okay, weird, but...
good to know.
Good to know, I guess.
Yeah. Which also... And that relates to the duty of care that police have. And I think one of the reasons there's a big distrust with the police in Toronto is that they failed in that duty of care with the community. So...
Well, not only that, but a lot of the systems that were put into place after Paul Bernardo, they failed as well. Mm-hmm. Which is weird because it's worked elsewhere in Canada, which is, I mean, both you and I have independently spoke with various experts on the issue, and there's a huge question mark over how this happened because there's a lot of automation now.
We'll be interviewing a missing in persons investigator to get the details of how an investigation is actually investigated.
Spoilers!
So that'll be coming up in the next week or so. Now, I wanted to correct something I mentioned earlier. It was actually the Toronto People with AIDS Foundation that had co-signed the letter.
Okay.
Don't believe that Toronto AIDS Society had. So just for folks, I just want to clarify that. Along with the Toronto Pride organization itself. I missed that bit.
Yeah.
Now, as we mentioned, I'm not remotely surprised they got the boot. They politely withdrew their application. And we are trying to secure an interview with the LGBT liaison for the Toronto Police Service, Danielle Bottineau, and hopefully we'll have an interview with her in the next couple of weeks to really figure out how, if possible, are Toronto Police going to try and mend that bridge? Because it's a lot of...
Well, it's going to be a lot of work.
They're going to need to build a new one.
Yeah. We're looking at, about 10 years. 5 years until people are hesitantly accepting, and about 10 to 20 years until people are okay.
That's assuming they don't do any more raids and...
This is assuming that they stop it with the screw-ups and they start taking it seriously. I'd say, you know... 5 to 10 years until the community's hesitantly okay, and then about 10 to 20 years until people are okay.
Well, people are demanding change now.
Oh yeah,
they're demanding an independent civilian investigation. It doesn't look like John Tory's going to go anywhere near promising that.
Yeah,
but they're demanding an independent investigation. They're demanding systemic change within TPS because what's happened is unacceptable, and how it's being dealt with to the community is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll find out from Ryan Tran in just a few moments how that has had an impact. So we'll be back just after the interview with Ryan talking about Grindr. Check out this interview, and we'll be playing a song by Partners, which are a Toronto-based group. And this is Play the Field. And it might liven the mood just enough. Ryan Tran from the Asian Community AIDS Service. Thank you so much for letting me drop in relatively unannounced and have a chat with you. So earlier we were talking a bit about how the Bruce MacArthur murders have had a phenomenal impact on the community here in Toronto. Now, a lot of the folks who were victims of Bruce MacArthur were Middle Eastern or South Asian, I believe.
Yeah.
How did that impact when you started to see the media attention with the list of faces and the numbers kept growing, 3 people connected, 4 people connected, 5, then you got charged with a 7th, which I still don't think they've identified the 7th person. But it's how you know, in the fishbowl of Toronto, how did you feel seeing that happening?
It's definitely scary. I mean, it's almost unbelievable that such a large amount of people could go missing like that and could be, definitely were killed because of this one person. It's unbelievable how it's been this long that these men were missing and nothing was done about it until now. And it can be frustrating, of course, very frustrating with how it's dealt with. I think a lot of people were scared, and when we start seeing like missing persons posters on the street in the village, especially, and it affected like my friends, people I knew, who were worried about walking around late at night after clubbing in the village, making sure that we get home together, or texting and calling in. It's definitely scary.
On our show, we often, because we cover
global news, and there's been, unfortunately, similar murder sprees in Australia and the UK and the States that had a similar MO to Bruce MacArthur way back in 2015-16. And we would say things like, you know, if you're going home or you're going to go hook up with somebody, text a close friend, let them know the address so that you know, little safety tips. And the kind of safety tips that you would have done if you were clubbing in the 90s, you know, like, there were things that you wouldn't think you would still need to do, but that seems to be the reality that we're living in, where it's not as safe as maybe we would hope it would be.
Yeah.
Which is really quite grim. Now, we were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, these folks went missing, and there was a lot of agitation around the police not appearing to not even investigate that well, or if at all, you know. And you mentioned earlier how there are currently, right now, two Southeast Asian folks who are still missing.
Yeah.
You know, how do you respond to that?
So it's scary, of course, that there are still two East Asian men missing. It puts a real face that does hit it, that even our community, my community, can be affected. And the fact that it took so long for all these to find out more about these missing Middle Eastern men, and then it took one white man for things to step up, for police to actually put in a lot more work to find him. What would happen if I would go missing?
Mm-hmm.
If I wasn't white, and I'm not white, sorry, and I go missing, are things going to happen? Are two police going to push to find me? Are my family going to be able to push to find me? Because my family are immigrant parents. They do not know much about how the system works. It feels like you need a lot of media attention to push for missing people to be found. And we don't have those kind of connections. We don't have connections in politicians or in media for people to push for us, for our community, if someone goes missing. We're a lot more isolated. A lot of these Middle Eastern men were isolated. Had I not even been out to my family, they wouldn't know that I would met this man on Grindr.
Yeah.
It would be something very secretive. So of course, my parents wouldn't be able to know how to find me in the first place or what to say.
And I think that was the case for, I think, at least one of the men, where he was a man that had sex with men and wasn't publicly out as gay and so on. So there was that wrench in the works. But this is not something that should be new to the Toronto Police Service. No, policing with a diverse community, married men are often caught cruising, for example, and how do you negotiate telling them not to go cruising in public spaces whilst also not outing them to their families? It's a difficult conundrum to face. You know, we were talking earlier, and you were saying to me that you felt that as a person of colour, that there's not the same belief, or you didn't feel that the police would investigate as thoroughly that if you'd gone missing as if you were a white person.
Mm-hmm. So what happened with the Bruce MacArthur victims, it almost confirms that people of color are less of a priority to be found for anything to be done. That already makes me feel reluctant to even report to police or ask the police to help. If we feel like we're not even prioritized or they're not going to do any work for us, what's the point?
Do you think that there's a trust from the Southeast Asian community in police in Toronto?
There's definitely mistrust. There's definitely a lot of distrust with the police, even for us Asian folks. I think when you're a person of color, your experience with police is different. You feel they're not prioritized, but you also feel like you're always under suspicion. I think an example that anyone could relate to is when if there's a police officer on the street, you're walking by, you automatically feel anxious, nervous, if you're doing something wrong, if you look suspicious, even if you've never done anything wrong, you've never had any kind of criminal offense, you're still very nervous and anxious. But as a person of a color, you know that some people can have bias, can racial bias and you feel extra suspicious. And of course, that's going to come off as looking suspicious as well. They could stop you anytime just because of the color of your skin. So of course, there's distrust there.
Is that something that you see in Toronto?
I do, for sure. I have friends who've had bad experiences with police. One experience from a friend, this only happened a little more than a year ago. He was actually with his boyfriend, so he's a gay Asian guy, with his boyfriend. They were walking around High Park, heading home, and they were attacked by this group of guys on the street. My friend was knocked unconscious. He woke up. They had called police. Police arrived. And my friend and his boyfriend ended up being told not to press charges, were blamed for the attack, saying the police took the word of the attacker versus my friend, who was Asian LGBT. And that definitely probably was the case where race and their sexual orientation did play a part in that kind of bias. Nothing got done. And that created a lot of distrust. Of course, if that happens, things like that happen is gonna make us not trust in police.
Mm-hmm.
The people who were supposed to help us, we can't even go to.
I know that a lot of folks who are listening may not realize that Toronto's huge, so we'll set Toronto aside for a second. But in a lot of communities outside of Toronto, the gay community is so small that you hear of one incident like this where the Toronto police appear to not take into account their side, even though they were the ones unconscious. Like, how were they the primary aggressor if they're unconscious? Like, it's really hard to fathom that. But that poisons the well. It poisons the chalice for everyone in the community, that whole friendship circle. So when you heard about that, I assume that other folks in your community heard that story of your friend and would have had an impact on their trust in the police as well.
Yeah, definitely. That story came around a lot within my gay Asian community. We all heard about it, and that just resonates. It's unfortunate that it could have been one police officer,
mm-hmm.
But it impacts everyone's impression of the police force, and who do we go to help? It feels hopeless, because then if we can't go to the police for help, who will help us?
Yeah.
If we can't even trust them.
Is there that sense, I mean, you just spoke to that example with Hyde Park, but I mean, the Bruce MacArthur police fiasco, because I think there's no other word for how, and I'm quite happy calling it an inept investigation, because they're now investigating the investigation, because it's clearly something went wrong. Like, they're willing to say we got something wrong. We don't have the details of what got wrong. We mentioned a couple of weeks ago on the show that it was handed over to the professional standards unit to investigate a previous investigation. So clearly something was not done by the book, and Toronto Police got something wrong. At least it would appear so at this point. So I forget where I was going with this question, but you know, you've got your example, which is just a tiny, isolated incident affecting one person that has impacted your community, your immediate community. And then you've got the police fiasco with Bruce MacArthur.
I know someone who hooked up with someone, and he had all his stuff stolen from them. He reported it. And again, nothing got done. Nothing happened. It's very embarrassing in the first place to have to report something like this from that you just had sex with this man, invited them into your home, and then turns out he stole all your stuff. So of course it's very embarrassing to bring up, and I already think that police are going to just laugh in my face, or they're not going to take you seriously because of this. And they didn't, of course. This guy had nothing. He reported it, nothing got done. And so again, that creates so much distrust, and everything just builds on top of each other, all these kind of stories. And it's a tough, like, if police are going to try to mend things with our community, the LGBT community, with people of color, it's very fragmented. It's more
so
stitches.
Is marching in the parade going to fix that bridge, or
No. Marching Band, everything's for show. I feel like a lot of these things that... Oh, but it was only like 2 months ago that... Or maybe a month ago where police apologized for something.
Yeah.
And that's just...
Yeah, I think it was Operation Soap they apologized for.
Okay. And I think the trust, this distrust is so big that no one even took that seriously.
Well, ironically, just to fill in our listeners on that, Operation Soap was the bathhouse raids, and I think in the late 90s. And then within 3 weeks, they did a $1 million raid that was almost identical.
At the park,
know,
right?
Like weeks later, after apologizing for targeting the gay community. Yeah, no wonder why people don't trust them. Like it beggars belief. Do you know of any folks who have not reported things to the police?
I think it's so common for gay men, for gay Asian men not to report. As an Asian man growing up, culturally, it's also a cultural thing that I grew up with, not wanting to report to police because it would cause trouble. It would add more trouble, be a bother. We don't want to be a bother to anyone. If we call police, we have to go through all the statements, everything. It's going to cause trouble for my family. So we'd rather not bother with it. But then the second part, of course, is the distrust already. It's the biggest thing.
So what do you think can be done can anything be done to kind of mend that bridge? Big question,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to take a lot of time. Trust in general takes a lot of time to rebuild. When trust is broken, it's going to take a long time to be able to build trust. It's going to take a lot of repetition. It's going to take a lot of practice. I mean, there has to be some changes in the police, in their system, in the protocols, something to mitigate racial bias or LGBT homophobic bias. There has to be a huge, deep change in the police system. But there's still these two East and Southeast Asian men missing. And I wonder, like, what's going to happen to them? Who's going to push for them now? This is kind of outside of our hands.
Yeah.
How are we expected to, like, find these men? Or how are we supposed to...
Yeah.
We can always advocate them, but it's so much out of our expertise as well.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like, who... We need someone to push for these other missing men.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have nowhere to go to.
Well, later in the show, we're going to be talking, or we may already have mentioned it, depending on where the interview fell, but we would be talking about the structure and how missing persons investigations are done, and how the system in place at the provincial and federal level, like there's two of them, should have caught any similarities and being able to link them to other cases. So... We don't know whether or not those two men have been linked to Bruce MacArthur because it's an ongoing investigation. Quite frankly, they're not going to tell us. And that's fine. If it's part of an ongoing investigation, we just have to have a trust that they... And that's it. That's exactly the key thing. We have to trust they know what they're doing. And that is made so much more difficult by the fact that there is such a degree of distrust.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine being in a community where friends are vanishing and your only recourse is the police, but there's a feeling of being left hopeless, I think is what you said earlier.
Yeah, it definitely feels hopeless. I don't know where to go from here with these other missing men. Like, it might not be connected to Bruce MacArthur, but then what else is going to be done then? Now it feels like it's going to be empty boxes on a shelf.
Yeah, and that's really, really grim. Now, you work with, because of course you work with folks who are living with HIV and AIDS, very unlikely to be AIDS at this point in medical medical time, but for folks living with HIV, and that's a fact, there's certain vulnerabilities that come along with that. Bruce MacArthur targeted vulnerable folks, and as we see with lots of serial killers, they target vulnerable folks. Is there a sense of greater unease around working with a community who may be more at risk than the average population?
Is there
more anxiety working with a population that might be more at risk?
Yes. Again, marginalized people, people who are more isolated, who have less ties to community, to a social network, to close friends, and then who have less ties to people in power. Of course, we have.
Mm.
It feels like, in order to get things done, to have for people to be found or have case work to be done to find missing people, feels like you need clout. You need to know someone, a politician or someone, a news reporter, someone in power, in order to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
As people who are already isolated or marginalized, we don't have any of that.
Yeah.
So then, it feels hopeless again. It feels we're stuck. And it's scary. It's because anything could happen to us, and no one would know.
So I want to step away from Bruce MacArthur for a moment and maybe leave on a slightly more hopeful note, which is really difficult because this is such a topic where not only have there been lives at stake, but lives have been lost. And I think we need to acknowledge that, the seriousness of that. But what I want to address is, we talk about on our show, you know, if you're going on a hookup, you know, text somebody, let them know where you are. And you know, I've been to hookups and like, do I really want my friend to know that I'm, you know,
yeah, it's
like there's some details that maybe you're not, you don't really want to talk about. But what are some of the practical ways that you believe men can take care of themselves, that sort of self-care elements to help mitigate the potential risks?
Yeah, I mean, screening. I mean, this one thing about apps, that good thing about Grindr and apps, is that you can screen guys. You can get a good feel of them. You have conversations beforehand online,
mm-hmm.
figuring out, okay, then making sure that they seem sane online at least. What I've done is I leave, and I'm a little embarrassed to tell even my gay friends that, oh, I'm going to hook up with this guy at 3 a.m. in the morning. My friends are probably sleeping or something.
Yeah.
But I leave a note in my email, in my drafts,
okay,
of the address. Okay, last hookup in the subject line, and I put in, okay, this is the address, this is a person, this is their number, at least something.
That's a great idea, because, I mean, that's often the first place they would look, is as a missing persons investigator, they would actually first of all be looking at your phone. There are people out there who care that are advocating, like ACAS, you know, you're a HIV population surveying organization, but you're doing this advocacy for these two missing men, you know. There are people out there who, if you don't have the connections to the media and the politicians, that there are still people in your community who will come together and help. What I would like to encourage folks is just reach out. The majority of communities have AIDS service organizations. I think Canadian AIDS Society is a directory of where they all are, if you're wondering where yours is in your community. It's difficult because people target folks who are isolated and vulnerable. So how do you mitigate being isolated and vulnerable? It's a tough call.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we're here too. As long as we're here for our community. So if they want, they can always reach out to ACAS, of course, and any other AIDS organization. At least it's something.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. That was Bad Influence by Baby Yours. Baby Yours is from Argentina. There's a great article on them in Out magazine, so make sure you go and check it out. We will be linking it on our website, www.canqueer.news. Now, two weeks ago, we were talking about Cockblocked, which was the website where there was an unsecured API from Grindr, and people and a bored software developer took the API and was able to actually display the list
of everyone who had ever blocked you.
Yes, and we had a great conversation with that. Well, turns out,
see, that was an internal flaw in the software. You had to register, get on there. You had to have
you logged in with your Grindr account.
Account, and it didn't do anything if you hadn't been online for long enough to have acquired enough blockings. But this kind of internal flaw is very different.
Well, it turns out from where we're about to go. Maybe there was more to it than that, because the API that Cockblocked was using also was able to access precise GPS location data.
Oh my.
As well as all messages and all media files shared. So it really,
well, I mean,
cracked it open like a nut.
You say precise, but I mean, if you and I both turn on our phones and so assuming Grindr, we both had Grindr, it would probably say we were like 300 meters apart. Yeah,
well, Grindr actually does that as a safety feature.
Oh.
So that you don't so that you can't be targeted.
They fudge the numbers on purpose.
Exactly, yeah.
But it doesn't mean there isn't a record of the actual
GPS in your actual phone is much more precise.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, it was a big serious issue. Anyway, the guy told Grindr, by the way, all this is available. And Grindr shut down the API pretty quick. Because at that moment in time, you know, customer privacy was like an actual thing that they took seriously in that context.
In that context.
Yeah. Now, in another context, and the head of security is very upset that it's being conflated with Cambridge Analytica. They were like, we're not selling it to political campaigns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're very different. So anyway, what we're talking about here is it emerged that Grindr was just handing over everyone's HIV status and location data.
And age.
And all of it.
And ethnicity and, yeah, everything. Yeah.
There's just...
And I actually have the privacy policy open right now, and I've been reading it. And let me tell you, I'm not going to read policy online, I mean on air, because I have respect for the audience, and you probably don't want to hear this. But the general defense that's going on in the media by Grindr is don't put anything online that you care if people share. Now, the way that I feel about this, because this is the privacy debate about, you know, do these platforms have a responsibility to protect your privacy? And I think you do. I think they do have that responsibility. But I also don't trust them to do that. So it's one of those things where it's like, whenever anyone's like, you know, don't put anything online that you wouldn't want your mother to happen across, I do that. But that's because, I mean, I live my life in a certain way, and you see where I'm going? Like, it's complicated because people should feel free,
yeah,
to feel safe. But on the other hand, how do you not know that it's not safe by now?
Well, I think the issue here is Grindr was telling, and they were applauded for this, and we didn't get around to this story,
yeah,
but they were going to set up automated messages to remind everybody to get HIV tested.
Yeah. And,
you know, there is a phenomenal new rate of infections in Canada. I think we're seeing the highest new rate since 2011. Mm. Like, there are concerns.
But it says clearly in their policy, okay, we are going to sell your stuff.
Who is reading the... Nobody reads the policies.
I am not saying that that's acceptable. I'm saying that that is going to be their legal defense.
They don't hand it over to advertisers as it happens. What they were doing is they were handing over all the information to software vendors who were checking for bugs and so on and so forth.
Okay.
And really the question is, why that bit of information? Why are you handing over that bit of data?
Hmm.
Why is that necessary? The AIDS Healthcare Foundation in the States, who said that it was a breach of confidentiality laws.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're not agreeing to the further disclosure of that health information. And if they were recording and sharing health data, they need to be way more upfront about that. So where the head of security was like, hey, guys, we're not like, you know, propping up Trump's campaign here. We're just checking for bugs.
Mm.
I mean, people's response is like, well, we're
not... checking for bugs, do you mean like debugging the software?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But people aren't, but everybody else's comments are like, yeah, but I don't tell Facebook my medical history. You know, it's like,
I don't tell anything my medical history. Like, I never trusted it.
But encouraging folks to be more forward with their HIV status and to do regular testing, all of these things are great. But why they opted
to disclose it is hypocritical.
Well, they've now decided not to, because they were stubborn for like half a minute.
Uh-huh.
They were like, whatever, everybody does it. And then they've decided now that actually they're not going to do that. They can actually stop sharing HIV status.
Oh.
So, but it's a trust thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there are still some places in the States where it can affect your health insurance.
Yeah.
So if that information got into the wrong hands, you may not be able to afford the care that you need anymore. So, I mean, it is dangerous. Like, I am speaking from the privilege of being a Canadian. You know, if I lived in the States, I'd be a lot more incensed about this. I'm not going to lie. But, I mean, I don't share information.
But many people do.
I know they do. I'm not saying that Grindr did something that is acceptable. I think it's hot garbage what they did. But it's also, it's not like this is the first time something like this has happened. This is old news.
Well, what I think people maybe who use Grindr and other apps may have struck a chord with them. Like, if these two firms that do the debugging got hacked, would you know who they are? And would you know that your every chat and every image and every single detail you've ever put in to Grindr was now out there because of that hacking?
Well, this is going to make me sound...
If Grindr got hacked, then you'd know and then you panic. But if these two companies got hacked, nobody would even know.
This is going to make me sound really sad, but if somebody hacked my Grindr account, they would find nothing.
Maybe you're a bad example.
Maybe I'm a bad example, yeah. Really, because, like, I don't want to treat people online in any way different from how I treat them in person. So if somebody opens a message with top or bottom, I'm like, dude, who does that? Like, do you go up to strangers on the street and ask that question? Which, by the way, is probably why I'm still single. Or if people just send me a picture of their genitals, I'm like, hi, my name is Sebastian. That's usually my response to that.
They're not getting away with it scot-free.
Oh, no, I hope not.
Yeah, a couple of Democratic senators are chasing them down.
Okay.
They want some answers.
In the privacy policy, which, again, for some reason I've taken the time to go through, they actually say that we do not guarantee your safety if you use Grindr in a country other than the United States. They're very explicit about that. That if they get subpoenaed or something by a court in another country, they may not have the legal recourse to block that from happening, which is not great. I mean, really what it is, it's a good motivation to bring back, you know, the bars and meet space. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. That was an old, like, early 2000s, you know.
Do you say meat space?
Meat space.
M-E-A-T?
M-E-A-T, yeah. Like, human, like, viscera space, as opposed to cyberspace, yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Above and beyond the security issues, the data breach issues, the privacy concern issues, there's also still the personal security issues that come with Grindr. And I mention this because, of course, we've been talking endlessly about Bruce MacArthur, but he used apps similar to this, the Target one. And there was an alert put out in the Netherlands. Mm. Dordrecht.
Dordrecht, okay.
Yes. In Dordrecht, there was a gang who, you could create a fake profile and lured two gay men in their late 20s to a parking lot and try to beat them up. One guy was quite seriously beaten up.
Yeah.
The police were only able to catch a 14-year-old, which gives me two questions. One, why were they only able to catch the 14-year-old?
Yeah.
And two, why is there a 14-year-old gay bashing? Like, what on earth is going on there?
Well, I mean, that's... gay bashers are not exactly...
age-restricted.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I know.
Or as they called it on Letterkenny, homophobicists.
Yes.
Which I think...
anyone could be a homophobicist.
Anyone could be a homophobicist, yeah. But I think this whole thing kind of comes back to that metaphor, which is becoming more and more common these days, which is, it's not your fault if you get robbed, but you should still lock your front door.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should take personal responsibility, and if there's something that you're worried about, don't share it online. It's small precautions. But that said, Grindr did rob your house. They deserve to go... to jail.
Metaphorical jail.
Metaphorical jail. Metaphorical robbing your house. And metaphorical locking your door so that you don't get beaten up by homophobicists. Yeah.
Well, we are pretty much out of time. We will be playing the whole interview with Catherine McKinney online. You can check it out. Lots of great reasons why women and diverse folks should be running for office. We'll play the interview in full, closer to the elections.
Right.
We'll just have a small clip of it today just to tempt you. Now, I did want to mention one thing, two stories that I'm not going to really talk about, but rather just say happened.
Okay.
One is New Zealand has unanimously passed a law eradicating historical gay sex offences.
Okay.
So sex convictions. And it's not all sex convictions. It's when you were convicted of sodomy, for example.
Just a blanket forgiveness.
Yeah.
Not forgiveness.
Which Canada did. Canada has done that as well.
Okay.
So it's it's nice that
this is the advantage New Zealand has of being a small country. There's a lot of things they do just overnight. You wake up and you're like, New Zealand did what? And it's like, oh, but they only...
So, and the last thing is, we've ranted a bit about Bermuda and the fact that they postponed enacting their marriage reversal, the only country in the world
until to... Until tourism season is over.
Until tourism season is over, as if they could get away with it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, a giant company, the cruise ship company Carnival, is throwing its weight behind the legal bid to throw it out. Now, this is important because they operate 24 cruise ships registered to Bermuda. Now, these cruise ships are massive.
Yeah.
Each one of them is massive. This is...
It's a floating city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
24 floating cities.
Yeah, yeah.
Each of them being like... The company's like, no, that's not acceptable.
And the way maritime... don't ask me how I started reading about maritime law. I just started reading about maritime law. But anyway, being registered to Bermuda means that's where they pay their taxes.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it. Hopefully this legal challenge will go through.
Uh-huh.
Coming up next is a brief interview, or the start of the interview we did with Catherine, talking about why people should run. We talk more about the whole process, and that'll be available in a week or two.
You know, as a council, we are responsible for delivering programs, policies, services in the most effective and efficient way possible. And there's often limited resources. But what, you know, some of the things that we do know about participation of women in, you know, in the city, in public space, for example, we know that women use transit in a very different way. You know, they use it more often to get shorter distances, whether it's, you know, to work and back, to a doctor's appointment and back, dropping off at daycare and back. Another study I did that was very interesting, was that showed that participation rate for girls using public parks drops off precipitously after the age of 9. And so, I was shocked by that. And I want to know, does that happen here in the city of Ottawa?
Yeah.
And if it does, we have to do something about that.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's shocking to think that in our communities, girls over the age of 9, for whatever reasons, mm-hmm. Don't feel or aren't in public parks
yes,
as much.
Yes.
I mean.
So is it, you know, so I think, you know, to go back to the mayor's statement that we just put the money into the services. But we have to know what mm-hmm. the service, we have to know what we're investing in so that it is the best use of our dollar, right? Mm-hmm. So if girls after 9, is it feeling of being unsafe? Do we need more lighting? Is it the way parks are designed? Is it the programming in the parks that don't cater to girls, you know, over as much as they do to boys? We need to know that. We need to invest properly. Another issue that Councillor Deans brought up, which is very interesting, was recreation programming. So, you know, in many of our, especially our larger recreation centers, you can buy a gym membership and it costs, you know, X amount of dollars, or you can do programming. And the programming, so the aerobics classes and other classes cost a lot more, but women use those classes
yeah.
more than they use the gym.
And men use the gym more than
yes.
those
so,
other classes.
You know, we should be looking at our pricing
yeah.
and how we cost things, because it's not fair.
That's all for now, and we'll be playing out with another song by Partner called The Ellen Page, and it's about how they keep getting confused with Ellen Page, but really it's just... You know, when somebody told me about this song, I was like, you know what? The amount of Canadian lesbian women I know that look a bit like Ellen Page
mm-hmm.
is astonishing. They all have the same look. Like, it's a dress code for a certain type of
it's
lesbian.
It's just a modern trend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Ellen Page look.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, they took the idea and ran with it.
It's like probably about half of gay men have the tattoo of the two stars on their hip bones.
Oh, my God. There's too many. Too many. It's unfortunate. Anyway, this is the Ellen Page from The Partners. I've been Luke Smith.
I'm Sebastian, and thank you for listening.
People say that I talk like Ellen Page. I guess that makes sense since we come from the same place. But it's more than just a regional thing. Cause if it's 50% merit,
damage.